Decentraland Podcast with David Amoyala.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the week of the Calcioland podcast, also the final episode of the month of April. I want to take a moment to thank all our listeners. We started a new phase of the podcast this month. Some things behind the scenes. We are about to break 50,000 listens for the month, which is really outstanding. So thank you to everyone who shares the podcast and lets their friends know. We also started a Patreon page, which we're going to donate all the money to this charity in Italy for the month of April. So before we get started with the show, I wanted to take a moment to thank all you guys. Not only are you co-writers of the show with your outstanding questions, but you are also part of the marketing machine of Calcioland. So we appreciate it. So today, since it's Monday, we have our winners and losers of the Serie A weekend. As mentioned, we have Twitter questions from our listeners. I have to say, the past few weeks, you guys have really outdone yourselves. Then we have a bonus questions and answer segment for our patrons. And we're going to close the podcast. We did just one interview today, but it's a long one, a really good one, a journalist I've been wanting to get on for quite some time. Riccardo Pratesi from Gazzetta dello Sport. And we talked a lot about Italian teams in the Champions League, Conte, like a wide range conversation that I think you guys will enjoy. But before we get to that, I am joined by our co-host, producer of the show, Alex Goldberg. Right before we started, I was congratulating Alex on the outstanding success of his own podcast, which is on Patreon. You guys should definitely check that out. Alex is absolutely killing it. So, Alex, I'm going to ask you this. Last week, after we were recording, there's been a lot of buzz on Conte, the manager of your former team, Chelsea, potentially going to Roma. And we'll get to in a second, you know, how realistic it is, what's going on there. But I have to ask you, as someone who experienced Conte at Chelsea, but you also knew a lot about him because it was Juve, the Italian national team. Like, tell me, what sort of statement do you think Roma would be making by hiring Conte?
I think the statement they would be making, David, is a statement that says one word: enough. Enough. In terms of Conte, and you have said this, is the perfect manager to bring you from A to B. If your team, your club is just a little bit all over the place, which is exactly how I've described Roma this season in terms of how their team has been constructed. And once again, for the 1,000th time, I think Eusebio Di Francesco is more a victim of how Roma was constructed. So I think that Conte is the perfect guy to come in and just decide who he likes, decide who he doesn't like. Now, some of those decisions might annoy fans. I don't know. I can't predict the future, but I know Roma's got a lot of nice young players, and you got to hope that Antonio Conte would take to them, and he would definitely see what Roma's building right now, possibly with their youth, and he would prioritize those players. But you bring in someone like Antonio Conte, he's going to go for results. He's absolutely going to go for results. He's going to implement his own style. You're going to get an identity, which is very attractive, in my opinion, if you are Roma. So I do think it would be Roma just saying, all right, enough. You know what? Let's get somebody who is very profound in his beliefs of his football, is not afraid to make some decisions that maybe other managers would be afraid to make. And I feel like Roma is also like, oh, well, we have such a kind of ridiculous squad here. We have so many parts, so many different types of parts. Yeah, we're just going to have Antonio Conte, who has done, I guess, in my opinion, a masterful job with the Azzurri before in figuring out, when you have a whole nation of people to pick from, in figuring out, all right, who works? Who works? Now, like I said, it could mean that Roma fans would be very frustrated already in September, October by some of the people he would choose. But once again, David, the statement I think Roma would be making is enough, enough. We're a top club, and we want a manager who really is just going to put his feet in the sand and just say, this is how I'm doing things. So it would be quite a statement, in my opinion, just that Roma's like, all right, let's compete for the top again. Enough of this herky-jerky stuff. So that's my opinion, David. What about you?
Well said. I think the enough is definitely a huge part of that. And again, we're just talking hypothetically. We'll get into it in a second, how realistic, at least I think it is. And, you know, to me, I really contrast it to when they hired Monchi. And, you know, they gave him carte blanche to do what he wanted to do, obviously, within the financial restrictions of the club. And to me, the Monchi hired was really a statement of intent at Roma, essentially saying, you know what, we are a club that's going to have to keep selling players. We are going to hire this guy who is great at discovering talent, selling them for more money and keeping the cycle going. Granted, Roma had that a little bit with his predecessor, but this was really doubling down on that. Now, Monchi ended up being an absolute disaster. I think we're going to look back in a few years and there's going to be a lot written about how he left off Roma. But to me, I see it really as the opposite statement. I'm with you on the enough part. I kind of see it a little bit as Juve going after Ronaldo, like having someone that was going to elevate the club. Now it's all relative. Juve and Roma are at different stages. But the way I see it, you're bringing in a huge name who's linked to other clubs. And I think with Conte, you are telling people the opposite message of Monchi. I mean, this is a guy who famously said about Juve, and interestingly, I found out during our interview with Riccardo Pratesi that he said this famous quote to him on, you know, you can't go in the restaurant that costs 100 euro with a 10 euro bill. So I think Roma would really be making quite the statement with him. You know, I always said for a while, like, how great would it be to have Mourinho at Roma? Like, he would really embrace the city. He has the swagger. I think the Roman fans would completely embrace him. But I got to say, Conte is maybe even better, because I think he's a better manager today than Mourinho is. But you're making the similar statement there. So as we're recording this, and you look, we know how quickly these things can change. We're recording this Monday early afternoon in Boston. There's been buzz about it. Conte was even asked about it while he was on vacation close to his hometown in southern Italy. When he was asked about Roma, he didn't deny it. He said, vedremo, vedremo, we'll see. Take that for what it's worth. Roma is trying to pair him with Torino sporting director Petracchi, who is a player, who is someone Conte knows. They played together at Lecce back in the day. They've remained friends. Conte, you know, has strong ties to the city of Turin. He was actually at the Torino-Milan game yesterday. So I think Petracchi going there would be helpful. Now, you know, I have my doubts. You know, is Roma, we know Conte wants a huge salary. Is Roma going to gamble and pay him that? The good news is that really wouldn't impact financial fair play, paying a manager a huge fee. But that would be quite the statement. Di Francesco, even after making the CL semifinal, was nowhere close to being one of the highest paid managers in the league. And the other thing it would do is, we know Conte is going to demand things on the transfer market. It's kind of like how having Ronaldo on Juve keeps the intensity up, because you have to keep him happy, make sure you appease him and whatnot. So I think it'd be a great statement. I remain, you know, a little bit skeptical, because the way I see it, Conte really has his pick of every job in Serie A, maybe outside of Napoli. There's buzz on Juve, him replacing Allegri. Obviously, Inter's been linked to forever. We know what Milan fans would do to have Conte. So there's definitely options. And I think, too, maybe the Bayern Munich, the PSG job. So he has a lot of options, but good for Roma for trying to anticipate this. So we're recording this on Monday. Assuming nothing crazy happens, we'll have our friend John Solano later on this week to get the scoop on it. But I'm with you, Alex. I think it would be an incredible statement by Roma, and I think it would elevate all of Serie A to have Conte on a team like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm on record once again still saying I'd rather see him at Inter, but either way, I think Antonio Conte at Roma or Inter is going to make Serie A even more fun, and I'd love to see it. I love him involved. I mean, obviously, I have my own ties to how the last season went at Chelsea with him, but he's still just a fun guy to have in the headlines and to be following. So I'll definitely keep my eyes on that, as will everyone. But, David, we kept our eyes on this past weekend and all the football, and there was a table shakeup for certain. But like we do every Monday on Calcioland, we do some winners and losers. So who are winners and losers, episode 215 of the Calcioland podcast?
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned the standing. So important to know we are recording this before the Atalanta-Udinese match. I feel less bad since we took a deep dive on Atalanta last week. Thanks, everyone, for the kind words. With the segment on Bruno Bottaro was outstanding as usual. So let's get into the winners and losers of the weekend. We're going to start with Raja Nainggolan, who saved maybe his best performance of the season at Inter for facing Juve at San Siro. Our friend Andrew Barker tweeted, he's a big Inter fan. He says, there are very few professional athletes that hate their team's rivals as much as Nainggolan hates Juve. Well put. Definitely an important goal. It was also funny to see former Juve director Marotta celebrate with the rest of the Inter brass there. It was a little awkward, but good for Marotta. You guys know I like him. So other winner in that match was Politano. I thought he's been one of Inter's best players all season. On the Juve side, we had Ronaldo scored his 600th goal at the club level. He seemed more engaged and energized in that match than the rest of the team combined. The exception I'll give is Emre Can, who I have to say has really, really impressed me in the second half of the season. I think if you're looking for a silver lining for the end of Juve's season, it's his improvement is what I would point to. Then we had Bologna. Talk about a huge match in the race to avoid relegation. This was basically a playoff game. They took out Empoli, beat them 3-1. We had Sansone with a great goal, Orsolini also with a goal. Sinisa Mihailovic, absolute one of the winners, not just of this weekend, but I'd say of the whole Serie A season. He completely turned Bologna around. So kudos to him. Then we had Napoli beat Frosinone on an away match. Mern scored his 81st goal in Serie A, tying Diego Armando Maradona. Really important for him. Then we had Younes, who's been kind of, as in Italy, we'd call him un oggetto misterioso, kind of a, not a bust, but someone who's a mysterious, you don't know what can he do or not, had a really good match there. Then we had Spal and Genoa, a draw between these two teams. Probably more exciting for Spal, who now get to 39 points. In Italy, we always say you get to 40 points, you're going to avoid relegation. They're right there. I think Spal deserves a lot of credit this season. They've been a much better team since Lazzari came back from injury. For Genoa, we had Lapadula score. He was injured for a while. Speaking of Genoa, their crosstown rivals, Sampdoria, they lost at home. Their former player, Correa, for Lazio, he's been playing really well recently. He's probably been their best player in recent weeks. And then we had Caicedo, who scored a brace. He scored 4 goals in the last 3 matches and all of Lazio's goals in these 3 matches. So him and Correa have been really keeping the team going. Then we had Roma, impressive win against Cagliari. We had Fazio and Pastore score, so they're both winners. They've been criticized a lot. I think Ranieri deserves a ton of credit. He's fixed the defense since he's been at Roma, no easy feat. Also, I mean, everything about Ranieri since arriving at Roma can be described as selfless. Like, you know, he is a big Roma fan, never hit it, and it's legit. It's not just, you know, someone who says, yeah, I'm a fan of the team. So, you know, he takes over midseason, doesn't get any guarantees for next season. After the match, he's asked, what would be your reaction if Conte comes to Roma, essentially to replace him? And he said, yeah, I'd be thrilled. And he says, as a Roma fan, that sounds good to me. And it was very genuine. So he's a winner there. And then we have Torino, who I'm going to pat myself a little bit on the back. I've been wrong about a lot of things, especially Gattuso, but I've been high on Torino for a long time. I've been telling people they deserve almost as much credit as Atalanta just because they don't do it in a sexy way with the attack. They're doing a lot of things right. That win against Milan, Mazzarri, really done a fantastic work. What I like about Atalanta and Torino is they build their team and their manager's image. So Torino, very strong defensively, hard to play against. They make a life miserable for their opponents. We also had Belotti, who scored on a penalty kick. But besides that, I thought he was really outstanding in this match. I think Belotti's really impressed me in 2019. I really think Mancini should consider calling him back to the Azzurri. The flip side, we had Handanovic, another of his moments where you feel like it's a PlayStation controller that's not charged enough and the battery just dies out of the blue on Juve's goal. We mentioned Bologna. The flip side is this was a very tough loss for Empoli, who puts them really on the crossroads of going back to Serie B. Sampdoria have been an absolute free fall in recent weeks. They followed up the terrible performance at Bologna that caused Sabatini to quit. With a home loss, usually they're good at home. Defender Colley, who we had praised in previous weeks, was really pretty atrocious in this match. And then the last two, we had Napoli fans. Callejon had played his 300th match at the club. After the game, threw them the jersey. They threw it right back at him. We'll get more into this with the question. And then the final loser has to be Gattuso. You know, I coined our new catchphrase, are we a two-game losing streak from sounding like idiots because we're praising this guy? And I'm guilty of this. I really, before the international break, the last one before the derby, I thought Gattuso was a shoo-in to stay at Milan, and he deserved to be the manager next season. That couldn't be further from the truth at this point. There's literally no offensive idea or all. When I think of Milan, I always think of the Italian phrase, il nulla, nothingness. That's really what sticks out to me about that. Also, Gattuso is like with these experimenting and moments of desperation, the three-man defense and Caldara in the Coppa Italia semifinal and starting Cutrone over Piontek. So sorry, Rino, I really respect you as a man and all, but this has been an absolute disaster. So these are winners and losers for the Serie A weekend.
All right, David, good stuff. And not to be corny here, but what's always good stuff are our Twitter questions from our awesome listeners, and reading through them, that's another really good slate of them. So, David, let's start off with the first Twitter question. What did you make of Lazio's response to the recent incidents involving their ultras?
So today, just so you for full disclosure, today the Sporting Justice in Italy is going to close the Lazio Curva One match over what happened in Milan, the chance against Bakayoko and Kessie and whatnot. We talked last week about the group of Lazio Ultras who had the banner for Mussolini the day before the anniversary of the liberation of Italy, then followed by that display at San Siro. So look, you know, I've always, you know, I kind of have a soft spot for Lazio. I like a lot of their player. They're a team that for years I've enjoyed watching. But I have to say, based on the recent response from the club, I got to tell you, I'm even at the point where I was thinking of just boycotting the team altogether on our podcast. They choose not to because, you know, to be honest, these are issues that are bigger than calcio. I've said it a long time. It's a cultural, political issue, especially right now in Italy. But to me, the response of the club, really, really disappointing. Their official statement after Bakayoko and the Mussolini banner was very vague. They're like, yeah, we're against principles that are against what we stand for. And then they're like, you know, it's not good when we paint all a few bad fans, we paint the brush on all Lazio fans. To me, that was completely unnecessary, like a really strong statement saying, you know what, we don't tolerate this stuff, and getting really specific about what it is. But look, you know, as Capello said recently, ultra groups like in Italy really are in charge. So there was this article in Gazzetta dello Sport, I forget who wrote it, that if there's a force in Italy that's really organized, that gets things done, it's ultra group. So it's a bigger issue than that. But, you know, Lazio has to really be aware of the branding of the club and how this comes off. I've had conversations on Twitter, off Twitter, with some friends of mine that are Lazio fans. And, you know, to me, this whole thing that we can't let a few people like paint the brush overall, like that's really too simplistic. It's really time for everyone else to really be a little bit more vocal. And if the club's not going to do more about it, you know, you may want to suggest boycotting. I used to be a big fan of the NFL, but once I started hearing more and more on the stuff with concussions, I'm just like, you know, I'm not going to be part of it. So I hope they turn it around. And again, I want to note that this isn't just the Lazio problem, although I think that with them, it's more so than in other areas.
All right, David, this next Twitter question is awfully interesting. Makes you think. Whose expectations are more unrealistic, Napoli or Juve fans?
So I have this theory And I think a lot of the reasons Juve fans, and I'd say especially Napoli fans, are very disappointed with their teams stems from the fact, one of the reasons that Milan and Inter just haven't been title contenders for way, way too long. So let's start with like the Juve. I get it. You know, you've won the title 8 years in a row. You add Ronaldo. You lose to Ajax, who on paper is a worse team. But I've also said, you know, who knows? If Ajax go all the way and keep playing this way, we might look back and be like, hey, Juve really lost to a historic team. But I think the fact that this last Scudetto really was a complete afterthought. Like, I've never seen a title that was least celebrated than this. It would look a lot different if, you know, Milan and Inter were giving Juve serious competition. Like, it used to be a while that winning Serie A was really, really important, and it just hasn't in recent years. I think too, last year, Napoli under Sarri, the strong run that they had made that title a little bit sweeter, but now this year, there was nothing. I think with Napoli fans, now the expectations is they have to win something, and I go back to what I always said, that people that mock Sarri for his lack of trophies are really not giving enough credit to Juve. And I get Napoli, they have a huge rivalry that Juve, they're not going to go out of their way to praise Juve. But I think if Milan and Inter were much more competitive, what Napoli has been doing in recent years to their own fans would seem a lot more impressive. Like, as we're recording this, Napoli qualified for 10 years in a row for European competitions. No club in Serie A has a streak that long. Not Juve, certainly not Milan or Inter, Roma. No one else. Napoli been in the Champions League 4 years in a row. When you look at Napoli's payroll and their revenues, that's a really impressive result. I've said it many times. I think Napoli, the way they operate, makes a lot of sense. As Ancelotti said, they can't sign a player that makes, you know, 10 million net a season. But they do find ways to improve the squad. Now, this year, you and I, Alex, we saw this coming. They were going to take a step back. But I think overall, the project at Napoli, a lot of the fans keep complaining that the project's non-existent. To me, that's really missing the point, and it's missing the point of what Juve's done. Like, I saw this video. It was an anniversary of a famous Maradona goal from the 80s against Milan, a home match. Like, the San Paolo was so full, 90,000. Like, Napoli now, when you watch them on TV, it's absolutely dreadful how empty the stadium is. So I think the decline of Milan and Inter, and hopefully especially Inter, they seem closer to come back, has really distorted the perception of Juve, but especially Napoli fans.
All right, David, how about this? Straight up, who is more likely to leave Napoli between Alon and Zielinski?
I think Alan, because A, he was closer to leaving in January. He's older than Zielinski. And I think Napoli, if they can sign Barella, sell Alan for more and then save on wages, that would make a lot of sense. Seems like Barella's pretty open to that move. Zielinski, a little bit harder to replace. I also think Zielinski didn't have particularly a great season. You could say neither did Alan in the second half. But I think Napoli is going to wait to see if Zielinski's value can go up anymore or maybe even keep him more long-term.
All right, fair enough. One of my favorite Serie A players, to be honest, but I haven't really talked about him much lately. David, could you see Lorenzo Insigne leaving Napoli?
You know, Insigne and Alan are pretty similar because in the first half of the season, they would have been shoo-in for the ideal 11 in Serie A. You know, it was all this talk, oh, look what Ancelotti did, reinvented Insigne as a second striker. He's been great, yada, yada, yada. And then the second half of the season, he hasn't been good. There's been a lot of buzz that he might leave. You know, Ancelotti's asked about it, and he's like, hey, you know, I'm not going to keep anyone against their will. I'll be happy if he stays, but, you know, we can't survive. I have to say, to me, no matter what, Napoli can't lose Koulibaly. If they have to want to rebuild the team a little bit and they have to consider selling one between Insigne and Alan, I might go, that's really close, which one of the two. I guess it would also depend on who wants to leave. Also, Insigne at his wages is right at the top of what Napoli current pays him. Paying him even more would be kind of breaking their salary structure. And I'm just not sure he deserves it based on the second half of the season. So I'm going to say there's, if I had to put it right now, I'd say 35-40% chance that Insigne leaves. And if you know me, that's a really high percentage.
Absolutely. That's pretty strong coming from David Amoyal. All right, next Twitter question. Could you see Atalanta going on a strong 8-year run like Napoli did starting back in 2010?
What an analogy. I got to give kudos to this listener because, you know, people have asked me, and we've done this question a few times, and always like, you know, Atalanta, this is their business model. Find players. Like, they used to develop a lot of Italian players. Not so much now. The team's almost completely foreign, and then sell them for more. And I wonder if that's really going to change. Now, you know, Atalanta isn't playing their last home matches in their actual stadium because they're restructuring it. They have a potentially making the Champions League. And Napoli back in 2010 is a very good comparison because Napoli, granted, they have a bigger history than Atalanta. They've won Serie A a few times. They've won a Coppa UEFA, but they also went bankrupt during this millennium. They were starting to come back up. So I actually think this is a really good analogy because Napoli never broke the bank since 2010. They've made consistently European competition. So I got to give credit to this listener. It's not out of the question that this happens.
All right. Okay. How about this? What chance do you give Raja Nainggolan and Pastore to turn things around next season?
Yeah, so this was a prisoner of the moment question. The person admitted it. Both scored this weekend. I'm going to say that if Conte goes, well, actually, if Conte goes to Inter and Nainggolan's a player he's really wanted for a long time, is it out of the question that Nainggolan has a Pirlo-like renaissance like Pirlo did under Conte? I mean, there is the parting aspect, the body type. But if there's a coach that could maybe make that happen, it would be Conte. It hasn't been Spalletti, who was the manager at his best seasons at Roma. And who knows, maybe if Conte does go to Roma, maybe Nainggolan pushes to join him there. So I'm not sure about Pastore. There's talk about him going back to Argentina. If he stays at Roma, I look at all the other good midfielders Roma has. I mean, could they sell maybe Pellegrini and Zaniolo and make a huge plusvalenza and then go with Pastore? Maybe. But I'm going to bet on Conte and Nainggolan if they are together between the two. But I'm not that optimistic either will come close to being the players they once were.
You know, it really wasn't that long ago that Chelsea had just won the Premier League title under Antonio Conte. And I wanted Raja Nainggolan so badly to be that CM in a 3-4-3 or even that right wing, right forward role that he was playing at Roma. And I saw it perfectly in Antonio Conte's system. So, who knows? Maybe he could have that resurgence. All right, David, next Twitter question. What's your take on the Allegri Adani incident?
So for those of you that haven't followed, Adani is a famous TV pundit on Sky Sport in Serie A. Sky Sport does the post-game interviews with all the manager in Serie A. And Adani and Allegri went at it very harshly after the game against Inter. Adani, in a lot of ways, is the mouthpiece for a lot of Juve fans that aren't happy with the style of play that Allegri has, and there was a lot of back and forth. Now, Allegri essentially said, you're not qualified to tell me because you're not a coach. Adani used to play in Serie A, and that was essentially Allegri's response. And he says, nobody gives me credit for all the titles, including the one he won at Milan. So look, there is a history between the two, but I'm going to say Allegri here was in the more in the wrong between the two. It's kind of ironic that just a few weeks ago, I was praising Allegri for how smooth he is with the media and how he handles things. Since then, hasn't been great, even the Moise Kean incident and Cagliari and this. So I'm going to say Adani, maybe it's been long-term coming. Maybe it was a little bit forceful, but I think Allegri has to accept that someone who's a pundit and used to play in Serie A has the right to ask him a question and disagree with him, even if he wasn't a coach. Interestingly, another manager who used to really, who clashes a lot with Allegri on TV is Arrigo Sacchi. And Sacchi used to say of his players, you know, you don't have to be, you don't have to be, uh, you, you don't have to be a horse before you can be a great jockey, saying that you don't necessarily have to be a great player to be a great manager. And I think this applies to you. Like, you can be a great pundit, even if you aren't a manager. So while I get a little bit that Allegri gets criticized a ton, I don't think that was an appropriate response.
Yeah, admittedly, I watched it. The clip popped up. I didn't understand a word of what I was watching, but it was very entertaining. All right, David, this question is pretty much right to the point. Is Serie A on a downfall?
I think compared to a year ago, there was a lot of momentum. Let's put it this way. There was a lot of momentum, positive momentum for Serie A. This time last year, we had a great title race, the only one in Europe. Had Roma making the Champions League semifinal. Inter was getting back to the Champions League. A lot of positive things, a lot of, exciting players in the league. Fast forward to a year later, teams did poorly in European competition. No title race to speak of whatsoever. The racist incidents, which I can't stress enough what a black eye is for the league. And I have to say, I'm trying to look at it as objectively as I can, and this is just not a good look for the year. So look, a lot can change in a year, but I'd say there is definitely reasons to be concerned, and I think the league really needs to be aware. I get the political climate in Italy right now, but this is definitely all the momentum that was gained last year, let's put it this way, has been erased, and there's potential that we're going to start going backwards instead of forward.
All right, fair enough. David, which top 10 Serie A team is a better version than they were last season?
Great question. So I think the easy ones are Torino and Atalanta. They're clearly better. Improved from last season. We already talked about them for different reasons, but they are the best storyline in Serie A. I'd say talent-wise, I think Juve is better than they were last year. I think we don't look at them in the same light because there's no title race and they lost to Ajax, which, again, I'm going to repeat myself, that elimination could look a lot different if Ajax goes all the way to win the cup. For sure. The other ones, Napoli, I don't think they're better than last year. Definitely worse in the standings. I think Inter is about the same, maybe slightly better. I think adding De Vrij solidified them. I really like what Lautaro Martinez brought to the team. So I'm going to say Inter too, but the rest, definitely Milan to me, they feel stuck exactly where they were since Allegri left. Fiorentina, Sampdoria, all taking a step back. So, yeah, I think it's fair to say most of the top teams haven't improved.
All right, very interesting question here. How come there are more young Bosnian and Croatian players in Serie A than, say, French or Spanish players?
Well, I think it comes down to the fact that Croatia doesn't have, big, rich clubs like they have, especially in Spain, but also in France. I think the talent in Croatia and Bosnia tends to be cheaper. There's less competition domestically to sign them. I mean, heck, for some Italian teams, it's cheaper to go discover a talent over there than to develop an Italian player in their youth system. So I think it really comes down to that. I also think there's a lot of really talented Bosnian and Croatian players. Right now, I think the fact that they're so close to Italy also helps. So I'm going to say it's especially financial, but also a little bit geographical.
All right. David, why would Chelsea sack Sarri, when they could face a transfer ban? What manager would realistically want to replace them with no reinforcements?
I'm going to kick it back to you. I'm also going to add, what manager would want to take over when your podcast blowing up and your fiery opinion? So let me ask you, what percentage do you give on Sarri coming back now? And what do you think, say the transfer ban holds, which I don't think will happen, but let's assume that it does. Like, how much of a hit do you think that is with getting a manager? Could they maybe sign a former Chelsea legend? I often see you tweeting about maybe some former Chelsea players, managerials. What's your assessment of the whole thing?
Yeah, it's really tough to know. I mean, a lot of it does depend, of course, on the transfer ban, if it's frozen this summer or not. And like you, I do think it will be frozen this summer even if their appeal gets rejected, they can get help from the Court of Arbitration of Sport. Gab Marcotti seems to think it's a slam dunk. Chelsea will be able to make moves this summer. But if for some reason they weren't able to make moves this summer, I'm not sure the Chelsea board would think Sarri's the right guy for that project. But I'm starting to wonder if Sarri actually wants to stay at Chelsea. He's saying a lot of the right things in the press when he's asked about his future at Chelsea. But I'm big into body language. I am. And I'm curious to see if he wouldn't even be that angry if he were sacked, or even if there was an amicable agreement that both parties would part ways. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised with anything with Chelsea these days. So you asked me to give a percentage. I would say it's still 60%. He will be Chelsea manager next season. But I just think it's so unclear because there are so many things up in the air. And who would want to take over if there was a transfer ban, David? Frank Lampard, probably. The rumor is that Frank Lampard wouldn't really be scared of the no ability to make moves part of everything. And listen, from a Chelsea perspective, if anybody's going to come in under those parameters, it should be someone like Frank Lampard, who really understands the club. And everybody knows, even if you're a Serie A fan and you just barely keep an eye on the Premier League, Chelsea have a lot of success. They win a lot of trophies, but they're so dysfunctional. They're so unstable. And I think it wouldn't be the worst thing to bring in a manager like Lampard. And maybe you do take one step back, but I think in the long run, you take two steps forward. So my opinion, David, last thing, I think Sarri, assuming Chelsea get Champions League qualification, I think he deserves to stay. I think he absolutely deserves to stay because that was the goal from day one. But will he stay? That's a different subject. So I don't know. Very fun what could happen between now and the end of the season. Never boring with Chelsea and managers, that's for sure. All right, David, this is an interesting question. From listening to you guys, and obviously I'm reading here as the listener. From listening to you guys, I know David has a day job, this podcast, all football writing and reporting, plus a wife. What are his time management secrets?
So, great question. I hate talking about myself, but I'll make an exception here. So let's cross off a couple of things. The reporting. I've dabbled in reporting here. There's been a long time. So never give me credit for the reporting on Di Marzio's site. So let's take that off the table. But there's still a lot on the table. So I'm recording this actually at my day job. I work in finance. I don't know, be 45, 50 hours a week. I'm in the office here. We do the podcast twice a week, and, you know, I try to write about 3-4 columns a week, sometimes a little bit less. So, you know, how does it all happen? I'll tell you, I'm a huge believer in repetition. I'm a huge believer in the 10,000 hour theory, which is like, if you do something for 10,000 hours, you'll get good at it and you'll do it much more effectively. So both my day job, I've been doing it for a long time, and the culture writing, I am coming up on my 6th transfer window on Di Marzio's site, which seems insane. And speaking of that, that's really what's my practice and what helps me with my articles, is still doing the updates on Di Marzio's site, you know, transcribing press conferences, writing in English transfer stories. Like, I see that as my practice. My dad's a violinist, and, you know, he always told me, you know, I practice my skills every day. That's how I get good for the concert. And that really stuck with me. So when I do the Di Marzio site, I really see that as practice for my articles. So because I've done so many, you know, good articles, hard to do, much harder than a good podcast, but having done it a lot really helps. So to anyone who, every time people ask me, like, do you have advice for writing or anything, I always say, just do it all the time, constantly. Like, I just never stop, even on vacation. I'm terrified of stopping. And the other thing is, you know, I'm very lucky to do what I love in a lot of ways. And obviously the cultural stuff, that's a hobby that's become a nice second career. I would do it for free anyway. Nice to be making some income with it, but I do what I love. And the other thing, you know, in my day job, you know, I've been doing it for a while. I'm at a company where they give you good life balance. So you have to find a company, you have to be lucky enough to have that. And the final secret for me is, like, working with a lot of young guys. Like, that keeps me young. I'm 42. I've been working with you, Alex, for a while. Some of the guys on Di Marzio's site, some of them are so young they could easily be my kids. Even some of the people at my day job could almost be my kids. And that keeps me really energized, like working with young people, you know, keeps me going. And the last tip that I'll give on time management, on top of repetitions, which makes you so much better at things, doing it more effectively, like prioritizing is so, so important. Like, I'm big into checklists, but not just randomly listing things. I always do, you know, the most urgent or the most important thing first. Like as an example, if I have a bunch of columns to write, but I also have a guest coming on the show and we do the interviews separate from when we record this part, kind of try to really organize your time in a way. Like I'm a big creature of habit. Like my weeks look a lot the same. You could tell me, what are you going to be doing Wednesday at 6:30 p.m.? I could almost tell you to the T every week what that's going to look like. So yeah, it's a little bit boring, but repetition, routine, prioritizing, doing what you love goes really, really a long ways. And I'm very excited to welcome our next guest, Riccardo Pratesi. We've been on a roll with journalists from Gazzetta dello Sport, which is one of my favorite papers that I read every day. So we briefly heard about Riccardo on a previous episode with our friend Steve Amoya, who reviewed Riccardo's book, 30 su 30, which is about his visits to all of the arenas in the NBA and covering the sport. So right now, Riccardo is mainly focused on the NBA. I also appreciate him hopping on in the middle of the NFL draft. He also covers the NFL for Gazzetta, but he is a big Calcio fan. So he told me right before we started recording that he's excited to talk about Calcio. And his qualifications are outstanding since he covered Juve and the Italian national team on Gazzetta dello Sport. So with that long intro, Riccardo, it's a real pleasure. Welcome on board to Calcioland.
Thank you. I appreciate your introduction. Here I am.
Okay. So Riccardo, when we were prepping for the interview, you told me that at Gazzetta you focused a lot on the Champions League. So we're going to get to your book later on, but I want to start here, because this has been a pretty difficult season for Calcio as a whole in European competition. So as someone who covered Juve, the Italian national team, you think there's something about the style of play of Italian clubs that is preventing them from succeeding or doing better in both the Champions League and the Europa League?
I don't think so. I mean, you can make a specific case for a single coach, but I don't think it's a trend. I think overall, the coaches, Italian coaches, are pretty much well prepared, very good in terms of strategy, great tactician. Yeah, we'll talk eventually about Allegri and the situation with Juventus that may be a little peculiar to home from there. But overall, I don't think it's a problem of coaching, approaching, or mentality. It's just that, the Italian teams right now, overall, as a whole, they are not as good as they've been in the past. Mostly have to do with, the recession, the economy recession in Italy. We are not as powerful in terms of money as mm-hmm. we have been in the past. And so basically the rosters are not as good as they have been in the past. So it's a simple matter. Sometimes, I mean, you don't have enough talent to make it happen. And also, I mean, Champions League is a cruel competition. We're in a knockout stage. I mean, it's just two games. And even in the group, I mean, a single episode can make a lot of difference. Yeah. I mean, you remember probably better than me that, I mean, Napoli was very, very close to eliminate Liverpool. I mean, Milik, at the very end of the game in Anfield Road, had a huge opportunity. He didn't score. And Liverpool right now is in the semifinals. And also Inter, I mean, Inter was very close to make to the knockout round. And in his group, they had, I mean, two teams that right now are in semifinals. So, I mean, Barcelona and Tottenham. And Inter beats Tottenham soundly. So at the end of the day, I don't think it's right to generalize to say that it's just the approach, the strategic approach, the mentality or whatever that, I mean, has been the difference for, in bad way for the Italian teams. Yeah, I think it's just a mix of single episodes and that the roster overall, the roster of the Italian team are not as good as they've been in the past.
Okay. Interesting, because a lot of people put it down to style, but I tend to agree with you there. So I think I know the answer here, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So we saw Roma last year make it to the Champions League semifinal. You know, as you mentioned, the Champions League is a lot about a single episode, but do you see Roma making it that far as a fluke? Or is it realistic to see a team other than Juve from Serie A in the Champions League semifinal in, let's say, the next 2-3 years?
I think it's very possible. It's not a given. I mean, Juventus is clearly the Italian team who is most prepared for the Champions League right now for many reasons. But, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised in the future to see Roma or Napoli or Milan or even Inter. I mean, these teams going to be competitive. And so, again, it's not a given, but I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Okay. So now let's talk about Juve specifically. And, you know, I think a lot of Juve fans are pretty happy, especially the results in Italy under Allegri with 5 Scudetti in a row. Maybe not so much in Europe. I think, you know, when they look at Juve's really impressive offensive weapons. Maybe a case could be made that he's not getting the full potential out of the attack. So I want to ask you, as someone who covered Juve, how do you view Allegri overall? Do you think Juve should maybe consider moving on from him and going with a different approach? And do you think ultimately his tactical approach gets the most out of the team?
I thought Juventus should have moved on from Allegri. But I will finish. I will answer this question, finishing answering the other question. I mean, in this moment, Juventus is the club in Italy with the best mix of, you know, money, great front office, great roster, and a great way to make money in terms of what they got as a brand. Mm-hmm. Even the stadium of their property is a huge source of money for Juventus. Is a money maker. You were asking me about the other clubs, and I mean, Milan coming from a bad situation in terms of the Chinese property, the owner just left. Now the Elliott Fund, they are the owner. So yeah. I think they should be able going forward to make the club better, more solid in terms of a financial situation, and that should mean that the team is going to be more competitive. At the same time, Inter had a little bit of shaky times adjusting to the Chinese property, but now they seem they are ready to, I mean, take the next step and to become a little bit more competitive. Even for Roma, I mean, the property once again is a foreign property. It's American in this case, yeah. Pallotta. And he's also, you know, involved in Boston Celtics and the NBA and whatever. And even in that case, I mean, Roma is a great brand, but the result can be, I mean, direct consequence of how much Pallotta is able or want to invest in the club. So I'm telling you this because Juventus, once again, is the team that right now is dominating with 8 Scudetti, 8 championship in a row in Italy, just because the mix of every element that make a team working, the players, the coach, the coaching staff, but the front office, the economy of the club, all together they form a much, much better package than any other club in Italy can show right now. And that's why it's very difficult to judge Massimiliano Allegri. I mean, he won 5 Scudetti in a row, and it's a big deal. It's never easy to win. It's never easy. I mean, there's so many things that can go wrong in terms of the locker room situations, dynamics, in terms of, I mean, a bad episode that can have lingering effects going forward. So, I mean, it's never easy to win. But at the same time, you have to consider that many Juventus fans are not happy not as happy as they should, or as you may imagine they would, just because Juventus has never been able to, I mean, win in Europe. And for many of them, right or wrong, they believe that in Italy it's easy to win because Juventus is so much better than the other teams that Allegri winning is just doing his job. He's just getting the job done, but he's not doing more with less, if you know what I mean. He's just doing his part. And when it comes to Champions League, when he should add something by himself because the competition is so much better than in Italy, for many people, he's not be able to do that. And it is the battle. I mean, because, you know, he played, I mean, he coached two Champions League finals and he lost to Real Madrid and Barcelona. So not exactly the worst team in the world, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, on his part, if you do the devil advocate, you can say, well, he coached two finals. He's been always good. He make it through the group stage every single time as a Juventus coach. So, I mean, you can't compare that much because in a knockout, you know, stage, everything can happen, and he always lost against great teams. Even Ajax is a very is much more economic team because the salary cap is not as big as Juventus, that's for sure. But if you look at the top 11 of Ajax, I mean, those guys are very, very extremely talented. That's for sure. So, again, you can make an argument, a case, a point for both sides. Personally, I do believe that Allegri should have done a little bit more just in terms of mentality, like you said at the beginning with the first question. Yeah. When you don't play Cancelo from the beginning in a starting lineup, you prefer the Shigio. That is a guy who just, you know, keeps all the position and he's not an offensive weapon at all. You send a message, and it was the same message that he sent to the team in Madrid when Cancelo didn't play. And that is, you are playing a pragmatic style, a defensive style, or, I mean, you try to, you know, to not lose the game more than to win the game, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
And so I think Juventus may have paid, especially with Ajax, the lack of urgency, the lack of mentality that you want, you know, to finish them when they had the opportunity to get it done, and they didn't. But again, it's more my opinion than I think something that could be factual. It's more my gut feeling that there's something that, I mean, you can, debate. It's just, I think if you had a guy, maybe we will talk about it, like Conte, that is a coach that is ferocious in the way he coach, they probably would have made it. But at the same time, you can say that Conte on a European level didn't have that much success. So again, it's very, very debatable. Personally, yes, I think Allegri didn't do well enough in Europe, and that's because of his mentality, that it was not a winning mentality. It was more like a great handler more than a leader, if you know what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we had your friend Paolo Condò on a while back, and he compared Allegri to Capello, and I think that's a really, really good comparison. So let's talk about Conte, who you just mentioned. So pretty much almost every top team in Italy has been linked to Conte in one capacity or another. We have his former boss, Marotta, at Inter. He's been linked to Milan for the past few years. As we're recording this, there's a lot of buzz on Roma being after Conte as well. He's been mentioned as a potential replacement for Allegri at Juve. I know you know a lot about Conte, so where do you think would be the best fit for him in Serie A?
I think I did cover Conte for, I guess, 3 years with Juventus, the first three Scudettos that he won with Juventus. He's a tough guy to cover, but he's a tough guy to deal with, but I think he's a great, great coach. He's a leader, a natural leader, natural born leader. He's a world leader. I mean, these guys, if they buy what he's selling, and they usually do, his players go to war for him. And that's a big deal. That's something that they add for every game And this is not a given normally, especially when we are talking about big stars, international stars that are paid millions of, you know, of euros or dollars or whatever. These guys, I mean, are used to the big pressure, the big figures. They don't care as much in terms of giving you something more just for the coach. And I think Conte is one of the few coaches that is able to do that, to get out of his players something more. At the same time, he's a tough guy to handle because he's a guy who is very demanding. He's demanding with the players. He's demanding with the club, with the front office. I mean, I was the guy who asked him about his future of Juventus just before he left, and he told to me that, I mean, he told me, you don't go in a restaurant that with 10 euros if that restaurant is going to present you a bill of 100 euros. That
means so you're the guy who said this too.
Yeah. Conte told me in one of the last games before he left Juventus, it was a video interview. And this is just an example, because to explain what is Conte. He's a guy who's going to demand a lot to the club. He will ask for players, great players, and will ask the players total effort, 360 efforts. And he will ask a lot from himself, too. He's the kind of guy who will never rest. I mean, it's easy to be around Conte before a big time game, because the guy is going to go restless. He's that kind of guy. But once again, I think he can be, right now, he's probably the best Italian coach. And going back to your question, I mean, it's difficult to see where he can do better. I think right now the latest buzz is Roma, and it would make sense. And I try to explain. I mean, Juventus probably is going to confirm Allegri, it looks like. Inter and Milan, I mean, first of all, Milan is not sure they will make the Champions League next year, and it's a big deal. Inter, they will, but at the same time, the pressure would be big time there. Mostly because, you know, Inter is a big enemy of Juventus. There is a huge rivalry. So, I mean, I'm not sure the fan base would appreciate him coming. So he will have to overcome even bigger obstacles. And Inter is still a club with a very ambitious that would ask him immediately to win. If not, it wouldn't make a lot of sense. It would make more sense probably Roma if they are able to make the Champions League for the next season. If they're able to finish in the fourth place, and they have a chance, of course. And if they do, I mean, he would have a project there. If they don't sell their young players, so we can go talking about Zaniolo, especially, who is right now the big prize in terms of the best prospect from Italy. Guys like Zaniolo, like Pellegrini, Cristante, I mean, he got young players there, and he would be able probably to try to start a project there going forward. It doesn't necessarily have to win immediately, but he will have a chance going forward to get better and better season after season.
Well said. Yeah, so we're recording this Saturday morning, just if people listen. And as Ricardo said, there's a lot of buzz on Roma right now. So let's see. So let's talk about the Azzurri next, which you've covered as well. And I think of Conte's jobs, what he did at that Euro with Italy, might actually be the most impressive. But I have to say that Mancini, who's the current CT, he's impressed me a lot. I have to say, I find the Azzurri are in a much better place now than when he took over. So you've covered them. So I want to get your opinion of what Mancini has done so far. And since you've covered the Nazionale and you know a lot about them, which of the previous CT of the Italian national team does Mancini remind you the most of?
Yeah, I will start with a confession. Roberto Mancini was my favorite player growing up. So, I mean, he's a guy I did cover as a coach of Inter, actually, eventually, when I was starting doing my job with Gazzetta dello Sport in Milan. I was a young reporter at that time. Unfortunately, I'm not anymore. But, I mean, Mancini has been always a great player and a class act as a coach. He's a kind of guy who is very totally honest, very straight, who doesn't hide himself under the political correctness and this kind of stuff. I mean, when I did cover Nazionale, the Italy team, from, I guess, 2008 to 2014. So I went to World Cup, European Cup, and I had as a coach, I was relating with Marcello Lippi, of course.
Yeah.
And Cesare Prandelli. I think Mancini cannot be compared to neither of them. He's his own guy, but I like the charisma, you know, the leadership. He's a guy who has a lot of charisma, in my opinion. Prandelli was never that kind of guy. He was a guy who tried to be friendly with everybody, maybe too many, because he wasn't as sure of himself as the other guys. Mancini looks to me like a guy who's very, sure about himself, doesn't have to please everybody, because you don't have to please everybody. You cannot please everybody in Italy when there are 57 millions of coaches. Everybody in Italy will coach virtually the Italy team. So everybody wants to say last word, and you can't please anybody. You just have to go straight on your direction, and I think Mancini is doing that. He's trying to develop all these young talent that he got. When you said he did a good job, Conte, with the Euro, I absolutely agree with you. But I think it was also the darkest times in terms of talent for Italy. I mean, there was really a generation hole in terms of talent that we paid in many ways, especially, of course, with Ventura, with a huge disappointment of not to make the Russian World Cup, and that was, you know, probably the end of that situation, that really, really bad momentum that we had in terms of lack of talent. And now we can see a new generation coming up, and I think Mancini is the right guy, the right place at the right time. There are guys like Zaniolo that really, they have a ceiling that is pretty high, I think. I think Chiesa and Bernardeschi are two other guys that are pretty, pretty good. And also on defense, I think a guy like Romagnoli, even Caldara, probably going to play more going forward. So we got huge, and of course the goalkeepers. I mean, we have Donnarumma, Meret. There is a new generation coming. Of course, these guys, they don't play. Not everybody's playing a lot for the big clubs they're playing for, but it would be huge if they can, you know, make some experience, especially in Champions League, because to get used to the pressure. But if you look at what Mancini is doing, I mean, he's making some guys play no matter what, if they play or not in their club. I mean, you saw with Moses Keane, Juventus, I mean, he wasn't playing, and still Mancini gave him confidence, and he was repaid by goals and great performances from the Juventus striker.
Yeah. As I've said a few times, you know, there's the saying in Italy, la fortuna aiuta gli audaci, and Mancini gave Claude Zaniolo before he even played for Roma with Keane, like you said. He started him, and then he started scoring for Juve too, so he started that spark. So very well said, and I agree on the talent. I thought the Euro, the team with Ventura, like Ventura got a lot of criticism, but it really wasn't a great team. And it definitely looks a lot better now. So I want to ask you one last calcio-related question before we get to your book and your career. So, you know, I cover calcio. I'm based here in Boston. I grew up in Italy. I thought last season was a great season for someone who covers calcio. Said, yeah, a lot of great content. This season, maybe not so much for a variety of reasons, on the pitch, off it. We have, I'd say, Atalanta has been a great storyline. The rest, you know, the teams didn't do great in Europe, no title race and things off the pitch. So since you've spent so much time here in the United States, what do you think the league, Serie A, the league, or the FIGC, the Italian Federation, need to do to try to improve the branding and how the league's perceived outside of Italy?
They should have a better marketing. They should promote the brand, like you said, much better than they do. The communication should be better. And mostly, I mean, it's up to the clubs to get better in terms of getting an own stadium, because it is a huge instrument to make money and to make the environment safer for the people. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have so many fans in Italy, but right now, I mean, because of the cost of the tickets, but because also for the fact that not many stadiums are good, are new, or are even safe. Many people are discouraged to go to the stadium and watching soccer live. They prefer to watch on TV. I mean, there are many different ways to watch it right now. You can watch streaming. We got the Zone. You can watch on TV with Sky Sports. And, of course, people can follow on the Internet every 24/7, every news. So I think in terms of the Italian movement, they should do a better job promoting and developing a brand. It was a big deal for Italy to have Cristiano Ronaldo. So yeah, we can name him, because we did a podcast without naming him, and it wasn't fair, I guess. And with Ronaldo, Serie A got a great value. I saw they had some commercial agreement with, I don't know, ESPN or some international broadcasting. But mostly, I mean, it's all about be able to get value to that brand. Because Serie A may not as big as it's been in past, probably, but it's still should be a big brand, because it's still, the tradition is there, the big clubs are there, and the soccer is still competitive, all in all.
Yeah, you know, I work with Di Marzio, so we do a lot of transfers on the podcast. So what I like to say is I try to get people to listen to the podcast because of the transfers, then some of them get into calcio, and I have yet to hear from someone who said, hey, you know, I started watching Serie A and I don't like it. Like, everyone tells me, oh, I just didn't know it was this exciting and fun to watch. So very interesting on the marketing. And, you know, what was interesting, I had never really connected the fan experience and what the atmosphere is like in the stadium with the teams actually owning the stadium. That makes a lot of sense, because Juve has certainly done a lot to make changes there. So
yeah, absolutely. Because you make your experience wall for Juventus Udinese as a brand new stadium of his property. But with Juventus, I mean, covering them, I saw many families coming to Torino from everywhere in Italy. Yeah. And just going to visit the stadium, they do some tours before the game. They got a museum. They got you can go to a mall and you can do some shopping before the games. That's a big deal, because it means you're gonna spend your entire day of the game, the match day, around the stadium. And basically, it's all about money that are circling. Around the club. And some are, they go directly to the money goes directly to Juventus, some not, but it's a big deal to make money circulating out there. If you're not able to create that sort of your own brand, I mean, it's going to be much more difficult to vehicle what you got in terms of the product they are putting out there on the pitch. And again, this is a modern soccer. We should learn from America on this level, because I mean, America is very good in terms of promoting all their events and be able to make the event not only some sport event, but a whole event that is entertainment, is drinking, is food, is everything around the 90 minutes. That you look for before the match.
So I don't think we could have had a better segue to the next phase that we're going to talk about. So you mentioned the fan experience and the event around the game and marketing and branding. So as I mentioned, you cover now the NBA and the NFL on Gazzetta. And your book, which we briefly talked about when we had Steve Amoya on the podcast, is 30 su 30. It is in Italian, and it is on your experiences covering the NBA. So if you had to describe the book, and we have quite a few listeners in Italy and a lot that read in Italian. So if you had to describe to them what the book is like, how would you do that?
Well, it's a diary, if you will, of my daily sport experience in U.S., but also is a mix of that with, the access I had as an insider, an NBA insider. I've been a beat writer for the San Antonio Spurs, the Golden State Warriors, the Sacramento Kings, and the Minnesota Timberwolves in my 4 years in U.S. So I did cover 226 NBA games. That's, I guess, is a big deal. And a lot of NFL games too, a couple of Super Bowl. And I went to the last three NBA finals too. So it's been, the book is a description of what is the NBA, the background of the NBA. I mean, all the going to having access to the, you know, to the locker rooms is a big deal, because you can try to describe the great champions, not only the speaker, but the man behind the champion, and all the dynamics that are covered normally, and the locker room dynamics, they are a big deal in terms of success or unsuccess of anything. At the same time, the book wants to be a picture of U.S. and of the different Americas, because I've been to like 42 of the 50 American states, just driving my red Beetle all around the U.S. in the highway, the freeway, and everywhere. And moving to any to a sport temple to another temple, I try to describe what America is, because there are so many Americas. I mean, I lived in Texas, in San Antonio for 1 year. I lived in Sacramento a couple of years, and then I lived in Minneapolis. I mean, they are completely different realities. And so, I mean, the sport and the sport lived as insider is just an excuse to try to explain, to make a picture of America, just the sport profile.
Very interesting. So let me ask you one question I had on this book. I've been to a few arenas, not a lot of them. I'm a big Celtics fan, but tell me about which NBA arena, or maybe the experience around the team, surprised you, maybe in both a positive and negative way. Obviously, it doesn't have to be the same one.
Yeah, the name of the book is 3430 in America. I mean, so I've been to every arena for the 30 teams. I mean, of course, in Los Angeles, the Staples Center is shared by the Clippers and the Lakers. So I have quite a pulse of the situation. But again, it's very personal what you like the most. You can say, this is it. This is my hit. That's my opinion. Anyway, I think the garden in Boston is amazing because of the tradition that is unique in terms of the knowledge, the know-how of the fans, that they really understand the game of basketball. I think the Madison Square Garden in New York is also unique. You can find a very different kind of people going there, tourists from everywhere in the world, just going there to have, you know, that mystique experience that is sort of one of a kind. And in terms of, the loudest arena, maybe may come as a surprise, but I think Oklahoma City was a total mess. I mean, Oklahoma City, I've been there a few times when Kevin Durant was there, Russell Westbrook, and I mean, they got a college kind of fans. Mm-hmm. I mean, very, very, very into the game. It's not every game, and I think most of them is because, you know, places like Oklahoma City or Portland or San Antonio, basically they don't have other sports franchising towns. So that's everything they got is the Spurs, is the Blazers, and in Oklahoma City is the Thunder. So I mean, they just focus all their involvement just in that franchise, and so they live and die with the result of their team, and it's a crazy atmosphere, that's for sure.
Awesome. So, Ricardo, what we like to do with a first-time guest is a lot of our listeners are writers on culture. They have podcasts, blogs, you name it. So, obviously, the industry's changed a lot since you got started. We're about the same age. So, let me ask you, how did you get started into sports journalism, and how did you find yourself at Gazzetta dello Sport? I know we've had a few of your colleagues. For those not familiar, it's the most famous Italian sports newspaper. It really is an institution in Italy. So tell us how you got started and how you ended up at Gazzetta.
Well, I graduated in political science, but in history of journalism. So it was something that I did from the beginning, and I studied for it. After I graduated in Siena, and I'm from Tuscany. Siena is a medieval city, very touristic place close to Florence. I went to Rome to do my PhD in journalism once again. So it was 2 years, and then I became a professional just in terms of doing an exam that is necessary in Italy to become a professional journalist. And during my PhD, after my first year, I guess, in the summer when the lessons were, of course, we had a break, I had the opportunity to become an intern for Gazzetta dello Sport. So I went to Milan for 3 months, and I started doing all the things that the intern do, basically bringing coffee to colleagues. No, yeah. I mean, I did a lot of stuff, but I mean, it was a very interesting experience. After the first year, they called me back again the next summer, and they started giving me a contract for, you know, a few months, then 1 year, and on. And after a while, big while, I guess, because it took me almost 5 years. I don't have any recommendation or whatever. So it took me almost 5 years, but in 2005, I guess. They hired me for good, and I was lucky enough because after working for the paper for a while, they put me on the internet, internet stuff, and I was able immediately to start covering big clubs like Juventus, Inter, and so on. In a few years, I was able to cover the Italy team, and covering Italy soccer team in Italy is a kind of huge deal.
Yeah. Okay, so let's close on this. So you come from, you have a very strong background. You studied for this and all, but then you did your gavetta as an intern, as we would say in Italy. What advice would you give to someone that wants to break into the industry today?
Well, it's to double check the fact every time. In this age when everybody brings you news that normally unfortunately most of the time are their opinion, and they become a fact, but they are just opinions. You have to be able to double check every single time. Even can be annoying for you, but you have to develop sources. They are your personal sources in the industry, and you have to be able to double check every single time, every situation, because there are so many breaking news that are fake news, and there are so many people that believe they give you an in-deep approach to the game or to the topic they are exploring, but actually they believe that not living live is nothing important. I think it's very important to double check everything. When you can double check with your eyes, it's a big deal. When you can double check with your sources, it's still a big deal. If you cannot, I mean, that news could be right, could be wrong, but it's never totally accurate, or at least you don't have the guarantee that it's completely accurate, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. So, Ricardo, this was a real pleasure. Really thank you for bringing your insight. Hopefully you'll be covering my Celtics winning the NBA title this season, although that seems quite unlikely. But I do appreciate you taking a break from the NFL draft coverage that you're doing and for hopping on to talk about culture. And I hope to chat with you in the near future again.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot. Good luck for the Celtics. I mean, this year Boston has been quite successful. So, you never know. Maybe even the Bruins and the Celtics. You got to know a lot from the baseball and football experience, but you never say never. So good luck and thanks again.
That's the show for today. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to everyone who sent in a question. As you guys know, we record a lot of these. So if you have another question on Serie A, transfers, TV, music, film, please send it in using the CalcioLand hashtag. And if you enjoyed the show, this is a free show available to all. Please leave us a review on iTunes. It takes 2 seconds to leave us a 5-star rating. If you leave a comment, Alex and I read them all. And these testimonials are great because they are from our listeners. They help us attract a bigger audience. And if you like all the content on the CalcioLand podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon. We have various tiers for you just to listen enhanced version of the podcast. We have a tier where you can read a lot of original blogs from me. We'll have Alex once in a while do video, and I answer a lot of questions there. I think that'll be a lot of fun year round, and especially during the transfer window. So thank you very much for the support, and we look forward to chatting with you in the next few days.